ॐ सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः This 102. Samanvayadhyaya etat. Samanvayadhyaya etat. Suktam di swastyakari bihi. Suktam di swastyakari bihi. Tarkai sambhavanarthasya. Tarkai sambhavanarthasya. Dvitiyadhyaya irita. Dvitiyadhyaya irita. Samanvaya. Adhyaye. Etat. Suktam. Suuktam. Suktam. Di. Swastya. Karibhihi. Tarakaihi. Sambhavana. Artasya. Dvitiya. Adhyaya, adhyaye, irita. Remember in the previous verse, let me just find that. Oh yeah. In verse 98, verse 98 said, the knowledge of the actual knowledge, the recognition of the meaning of the vakya, of the statement, aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. That knowledge, until that knowledge becomes very firm, like dridha, until yavat, yavat means until, to which time that knowledge becomes very firm, one needs to do shravana manana nididhyasana. Shravana is listening to this vision, manana is understanding it logically, and nididhyasana is contemplating upon what you've understood at the time of teaching. That has to be done along with shama, dhamma, upadati, all of these values, ways of handling your mind. You know, the shama, dhamma, upadati, titiksha, shraddha, samadhanam, shraddha, all of these values that we've been through. This has to be done. And it says, he says, then the next verse in 99, he says, you know, certainly, but certainly, bhadam. There are reasons, you know, there are several reasons. There are causes for this adharja, for this lack of nishtha. One is that there are many shrutis. All of the Upanishads and all of the different verses, there's many of them. And they can seemingly say contradictory things. That's one of the reasons. Another reason is that the vision itself doesn't seem tenable, that I'm the whole. And so that needs to be understood thoroughly and logically how it can't be any other way. You know, that's the second reason. That's taken care of by manana. The first one is by shravana. The next one is called viparita bhavana. That's the third one. That's taken care of by nididhyasana. Viparita bhavana is that sense of being the opposite of what I am. A mistaken, a notional idea of myself, like I am this body. I am the sense organs. I am the mind. I am the body-mind complex. That's viparita bhavana. So it's a mistaken sense of self. I have a sense of self, but I mistake it by the anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition. So there's these three, right, are the basic reasons. And so he went through, in the next two verses after that, in 100 and 101, talking about shravanam. And he said in verse 100, in the Karmakanda, in the four Vedas, in the Karmakanda, there are many, many different rituals and different ways of doing the rituals, because there's different branches, like the Taittiriya, in one of the Samaveda or the Yajurveda, there's two shakas, two branches. There'll be slight differences in the way these rituals are done and the reasons that you do the ritual, the different rituals for different things. So the vision is not all the same. It's not like they're all, everything in the Karmakanda and all of the different branches and all of the four Vedas in the Karmakanda, that they're all focusing on one vision. They're not, because your own desires are many, you know, and the different rituals are many to accomplish all kinds of different things. So they're not going to funnel into one tatparya. Tatparya means one essential vision. They are made of many, many different things, many different karmas that can be done to take care of different situations or different desires. And so it talks about that. And then in the next verse it says, so he says in that verse 100, he says, but don't think that that's like that for the Upanishads. The Karmakanda is like that. But not the Uttarakanda, the Jnanakanda. The Jnanakanda is the Upanishads, the second portion of the Vedas. It's not the same. For the Upanishads, all of the Upanishads have one central vision, one essential vision. That essential vision is called the Tatparya. The Tatparya is what are the Upanishads saying? What is an Upanishad for? What is the knowledge that it's trying to convey? And so, don't think that all of these Upanishads are conveying something different. From this one you learn this, from this one you learn this, from this one... No. All of the Upanishads are converging on the same identical Tatparya. And that Tatparya is that the Atma is Brahman. That yourself, that the conscious being that you are, that we call the Atma, right? This Atma starts out as the individual self. It's the conscious being that you get to through going through the Upadhi. The self that you identify with, this body, mind, sense organs, right? That Atma is in fact Brahman. That Atma is really the self of this whole creation. And it is the substance of the substance of the creation. It's the non-dual whole. So you are that. So that Aham Brahmasmi, that Mahavakya, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, or Tetvamasi, that thou art, all of these famous, you know, I am Atma, Brahman, this Atma is Brahman, you know, Prajnanam Brahman, consciousness is Brahman, this is for the major Mahavakyas. There's many Mahavakyas. All of them have the same Tatparya, that you are Brahman. So he says, don't think that these Upanishads, this Uttarakhanda, the second part of the Vedas, is like the first. It isn't. So then he says, all of the Upanishads, all of the Vedanta, Vedantanam, Asheshanam, all of the Upanishads, all of the Vedanta is the Upanishads, Vedanta, that which comes at the end of the Vedas. So for all of the Vedantas, so if you say Vedantanam, Asheshanam, without remainder, without anything left over, all of the Upanishads, the beginning, middle, and end. Any given Upanishad, you take the beginning, the middle, and the end, and you take all of the Upanishads without remainder, Brahmatmani eva tatparyam. The tatparya, the essence of that Upanishad, is that you are Brahman. Okay, that is the teaching. So this knowledge is Shravana, okay? This is Shravana. That understanding the vision, the actual vision of all of the Upanishads as Aham Brahmasmi. The Shravanam is the unfoldment of all of the Upanishads. And the doubt will be in here where the vagueness, the lack of nishta that can come in this regard is that not understanding the actual vision of the Upanishads. Does the Upanishad say this? Or does it say this? What does the Upanishad really say? How is the Jiva identical with Brahman? What is Ishvara? What do the Upanishads really say Ishvara is? So there can be lack of nishta, dridha, lack of that nishta in reference to having actually gaining the vision that the Upanishads have to give. Right? You see what I'm saying? So that part, that's Shravana. Shravana is, of course, the Upanishads are meant to be taught. They're meant to be unfolded. The Upanishads themselves are a teaching methodology. So the Upanishad student has to to receive that teaching methodology. Has to be taught. And so the student has to receive the unfoldment of the Upanishad, which is the teaching methodology. But what you say, you go out, get all the way through one Upanishad, which will be complete, but there'll still be doubts, and we go through another Upanishad. Then we go through another Upanishad, and through another Upanishad. You see this vision always resolving in yourself as Brahman. From all of these different Upanishads, but they'll come at it from a different angle. Like for one will come at it more from the creation, one more from Ishvara, one more for the Jiva. One has different students asking different questions. So the Upanishads will come at the same vision from different angles, and that's why we study, you know, all of them, just for that thoroughness. But what you have to understand, also, that to gain that vritta, you have to see all of these Upanishads unfolding the exact same reality. So you're seeing the reality that each one is unfolding, and you're seeing that all of them are unfolding the same reality. So you gain a nishta in that vision. See what I mean? Because you understand what the Upanishads, what it is that the Upanishads, you gain the vision that the Upanishads are giving. You become very clear. So you have dridha now in terms of the actual vision that the Upanishads are giving. So here in this verse it says, it talks about now the Brahma Sutras. What the Brahma Sutras are is divided into four chapters. And the Brahma Sutras are an analysis of the Upanishads and the vision of the Upanishads. So the first chapter, called the Samanvaya Adhyaya. So here if you see that, Samanvaya Adhyaya. In the Samanvaya Adhyaya, in the chapter on the Samanvaya, Samanvaya means the chapter that looks at all of the Upanishads and proves and analyzes them, showing that all of them are saying the same thing. So it's an analysis of all of the Upanishads. So it says Samanvaya Adhyaya means chapter. So in the Samanvaya Adhyaya, in that chapter, Etat Suktam, this is very well said. So this is clearly said. What is clearly said? That the Tatparya of all of the Upanishads from beginning, middle, and end have their Tatparya in the self as Brahman. Right? This is clearly stated in the first chapter of the Brahma Sutras, which is an analysis. The first chapter is an analysis of how all of the Upanishads have the same vision. Okay? So that's, now he's finished with the Shravana. Shravana will remove the vagueness and the lack of clarity around the vision itself. So the teaching methodology, the teaching of the Upanishads, becomes very clear. Right? So Shravana removes that once the Shravana is complete. Then he says, Di swasjakadi bihi tarakaihi sambhavana artasya vitiya adhyaye irita. But in the second chapter, vitiya adhyaya, but in the second chapter of the Brahma Sutras, irita, it is shown what? The sambhavana artasya, the tenability, the possibility. Sambhavana means this is possible. This is a reality. The sambhavana, the possibility artasya of this, proving the reality of the vision of the Upanishad. So the sambhavana means the possibility, tenability artasya of it, of the meaning. Tarakaihi, by logic, through the use of logic. Now we've gone beyond, but you understand you've seen what the Upanishad said, but now your mind will come and say, yeah, but couldn't it be this way? You know? Or what about what the Buddha say? What about what the Sankhya says? What about what yoga says? These are just different darshanas that were happening at that time. What about what the Charvaka says, say, or the Nyayayakis say? Or we would say, you know, what about what the Christians say, or the Muslims say, or the Buddhists say, or the Tibetan Buddhists? Are they saying this? What about the yogis? Is this what they say? Don't they say something different? You know? What about science, which just negates the possibility of the whole thing, with certain scientists? What about that? So now these are doubts that are not born, these doubts are not born of the vision that's being given to you from Shravana, These are all the doubts that are coming from every place else, including your mind, your own mind, from your exposure to life and your own logic and the different religions and philosophies that you've been exposed to and the different culture that you've been exposed to. That itself generates all kinds of doubts. And so manana has for its purpose the quelling of these doubts by showing the sambhavana, the possibility of this meaning. The sambhavana means proving it, proving this meaning, tarakaihi, by logic, through the use of logic, which he says, di swastya karibihi, which this logic, which brings about a satisfaction, swastya, a satisfaction to the mind. The mind will relax, right? Because say if you say, like for instance, you know, everybody knows the 10th man story, right? I'll tell that again. Yeah. You all know the 10th. You know, the logic that the Upanishad would just be, you are the 10th man, you know, Aham Brahmasmi, you are the 10th man, Tetramasi, you are the 10th man, right? That's the Upanishad. But then the guys say, how can I be the 10th man? You know, how can that be? You know? And then he has to go, he has to do the tarka, the logic, by the counting of those other nine. That's the elimination of every other possibility. Right? No, it can't be that, it can't be that one, it can't be that, it can't be that, it can't be that. You get to nine, there's no other option, you have to be that. So here, this is your doubt. Say you gain this, you're gaining this vision. But then, say your Buddhist conditioning, or your Christian conditioning, or your Muslim conditioning comes up, you know, or your martial arts conditioning, whatever it is, you know, or your notions, whatever you had gathered some, in some way, you will say, well, couldn't it be this way? And why should it be, why shouldn't it be that, this way, instead of, why should it be this way instead of that way? You know, and what difference does it make? Why can't it be both ways? You know? And so, for the sake of clarity, these things have to be understood, you know, so that your mind can relax, because there's a vision here to be seen, right? It's not a vision to be, it's not like a theory. It's not like a theory. It's not the presentation of a theory that we're going to debate. The Upanishads are a teaching methodology, and then your mind sees it, and then still seeing it, it has all kinds of different questions that just are brought about by your culture and your exposure. Those questions have to be brought up one by one and satisfied. That swastya, di means the intellect. Swastya means the satisfaction of your mind. So karibihi, tarakaihi, by logic, which satisfies your mind, you know? And then your mind can say, oh yeah, okay, I see that. That's right. But every time, right? It says, oh yes, I see that. When it sees it, then that little piece of agitation gains the swastya, right? It goes into a state of resolution. But then they're like, yeah, but why couldn't it be like this? I think it might be like that. So that has to then be analyzed. Then your mind sees. Because remember, what this vision is, there's no compromise in this vision. This vision is Advaita, one without a second. That means there is nothing here but Satchidananda. That the conscious being that you are is one without a second. That is it. There isn't a second thing. You know? And so that's a very big vision. So either there's no second thing, or there is. Right? Or you could say there's nothing. Look at the different problems here. Like you can say, the Buddhists don't really say this, but this is imposed on them. There is only mitya. There's no satyam, there's only mitya. It means there's no name, there's all of these names and forms that are all interrelated with each other, but it's like peeling an onion. If you peel the onion, there's no center. So that would be like saying, everything is mitya, you know? There is no satyam. There is no there is no reality. We would say there is no self. The Buddhists would object to that immediately because they don't like to use the word self, because the word self only applies to the upadhis, like we use it in the world. Right? I mean, if that's going to be our definition of self, the Vedantin will say there's no such thing either. Right? Why? Because the body is infinitely divisible. Where's the self there? The sense organs are infinitely divisible. Where's the self there? The mind is, you know, everything is a conglomerate. Everything is infinitely divisible. Everything comes into being and goes out of being. Where's the self? Is the self in your ear? Is the self in your brain? Is the self in your heart? You know, and what part of your heart? The right side or the left side? The upside or the downside? Is it in one of the cells? Where is it? You know, so we can't find any self here in the upadhis. You know, so if we're using the self in that type of way, then it becomes, you know, suspect. And the Buddhist using the self that way will say there is no such thing as a self. There is no such thing in this creation. You can't find any substance in this creation. Everything is dependent on everything else, infinitely divisible and anitya, bound by change. Vedanta will say the same thing in terms of the creation. But then, what is satyam? What is mithya? Where is the satyam? So, this can be approached from different ways. There are different teaching methodologies, different emphasis. It can be approached in different ways. You know? But that has to be clear to you exactly what everybody's saying. Sometimes they're not saying the same thing. Then if they're not saying the same thing, are they right or they're wrong? There's a big difference between saying, I am the whole. I am Ishvara. Really. I am the whole, satya mithya, understanding that. And then what if I think, like if I went to Sankhya, this whole physical world is a physical reality and I'm a little pocket of consciousness. You know, and in order for me to be free, I have to bring this physical reality that we call the prakriti, you know, that it's responsible for every aspect of the body, mind, sense organs. I have to be free of it, I have to bring it into quiescence. In order for the purusha, the self, to be uncontaminated and to be free. So there's all kinds of things. So what if you say to me, why can't it be like that? You know? And what difference would it make if it were? So those are doubts. All of those doubts have to be worked through. Whatever your psyche brings. And what it brings is going to be based on your knowledge and the time of our birth, like we're in this particular period, you know, this century, in the United States. And so we have a whole bunch of notions and ideas and education in a particular way. You know, we have a whole religious and spiritual potpourri in this global world. So we have to be aware of all of that. And the student has to be able to ask and analyze, and you have to be able to be there. To totally to say, yes, okay, let's look at this. And let's take this apart and dissect it and see what it means, all means logically. So to understand here, manana. Manana means this type of analysis. And what's important to understand here, and so now Shravana and Manana, look at how both of them totally involve your mind, your intellect. There isn't anything about bypassing your thinking or bypassing your seeing. They wouldn't accept that at all. So it's like we don't accept emotional bypass. Most people know what that is, you know, emotional bypass where, you know, sometimes in Zen, they used to call the Zen Buddha sometimes walking heads. Walking heads because they would bypass. They're not only the Buddhists deserve that. That can be, anybody can deserve that kind of a statement, right? Where you just kind of bypass your emotional life. Just kind of swallow it, you know. But what about your intellectual life? That's also intellectual bypass, you know. In India, intellectual bypass isn't there. Your mind needs to be able to understand. Why? Because the problem that you're having, and this is not just true in Vedanta, this is much more of an Eastern orientation, in general, the problem that you're having doesn't have to do with reality. It has to do with ignorance of reality. The bondage itself is a product of ignorance. It's not a product of what actually is. The ignorance that your being, who you actually are, is fine, is free. So the problem that we're suffering from belongs to the mind, you know? And you can't bypass the mind. You can drug it to death, perhaps, you know? You know, drug it, or just do what people do in samsara. They try to keep it busy, keep it distracted, you know? So drug it, keep it distracted, try to hold it in some sort of a meditative state that you can't let go of, because the instant you let go of, it'll be back in your samsara, because it doesn't understand, right? And so almost all of the different darshanas in India put such a heavy emphasis on knowledge, because the problem is ignorance, is one of ignorance. So this understanding has to come in one way or another. So the Vedanta, I'd say one of its strongest, the thing that is most helpful about Vedanta is that it is so thorough in terms of making your mind actually see, making it understand. And every time, just like in samsara, in relative knowledge, when you understand something, the mind becomes quiet in reference to that. In reference to that doubt. Once you understand it, then okay, that's good, all right, you can move on. Now, in Vedanta, it's the same way. You have a doubt, you don't understand something, that has to be resolved. When it's resolved, all right, the mind is fine there. But then the next one comes. That one has to be understood. So that is the process. You know, in the West, we're not so used to having our doubts welcomed, because that's not in our tradition. Our tradition, the Christian, Judeo-Christian tradition, especially Christian, is so based on faith and mystery, you know, and so the answer will be much more the zeitgeist, or the way that we deal with these things is that these things you can't know. You believe them, you accept them on faith. And we take doubt as a natural thing, because you're accepting something on faith. Of course you're going to have doubt. Christians accept that. You know, because you're accepting the teaching. It's a belief. It's a mystery. It's not meant for logical understanding. And so that's just becomes a matter of faith. And the doubt will go along with that faith. But you don't. They don't expect to have a resolution of doubt. In fact, that's part of their teaching, in fact. You know, because people were feeling like they didn't have faith because they had doubt. And so they had to spend some time. Christians had to spend, theologians had to spend time for people to make it clear that, well, the doubt is something that, accepting that doubt is part of the faith. Mm-hmm. Because since you can't know, you're accepting a mystery, you're believing in a mystery, you know, that doubt is going to go with it. You know? So that's our upbringing, in a sense, is that in these type of spiritual concerns, religious concerns, are simply belief. It's not something that you can know. You know? The only things that you can know are things that are taught, that are available to you through your five sense organs, and inference and presumption and all of these things, right, are all based on sense perception. So in the West, because we're so conditioned in this way and so scientifically oriented, even for us to accept the Upanishads themselves as a pramana, as a teaching methodology, because the Upanishads also don't present themselves as a belief or as an indirect knowledge. The first part of the Vedas present themselves as an indirect knowledge, a revealed knowledge of an indirect knowledge that you can't have direct knowledge of. Like the different heaven worlds, hell worlds, punya papa, where you go after death, what happens, karma, how these rituals, throwing ghee into a fire will cause the rains to come. All of these things we don't know. It's all revealed knowledge in the first part of the Vedas. The Upanishads are not a revealed knowledge in this way. They're a revealed means of knowledge to make you recognize there's a difference. Like my eyes are a means of knowledge for seeing color, my ears for hearing sound. Inference is a means of knowledge I have for being able to see something that has an invariable relationship. Like if I see smoke on a hill, I can infer that there's fire because there's an invariable relationship there. So I have these means of knowledge that allow me to gain knowledge in the world. Vedanta, the Upanishads say, I am a means of knowledge for knowing the self, for knowing the reality of this creation. Okay, that means now that takes some Shraddha. And for a Westerner, how's a Westerner going to have that Shraddha? They do. But it's considered some Ishvara Nugraha. What does that Shraddha look like? It's that when you hear this, it's because it's coming to you from out of your culture, out of the culture, right? Something in your mind, you hear the Upanishad being unfolded, and something about it rings true as you're exposed to it, that in your mind gives you the go-ahead to say, I want to know what the Upanishad has to say. It gives you that go-ahead. And then you have to see whether it functions as a pramana. There's no way for you to know that anything is a pramana, is a means of knowledge, unless you use it. Swamiji often joke, you know, and tell stories about the person who was blind, and a surgeon asked him, you know, we have a new surgery. We do this surgery on your eyes. We can remove these cataracts and you'll be able to see. Yeah. But that person has to agree to the surgery. Okay? And then once the surgery has taken place, he has to make a decision to remove the bandages and look through his eyes. If he does that, if he is willing to look through his eyes, then he can see. But what if he says, this is how Swamiji will go on and on. What if he goes like this? I don't believe that I can see. I don't think I want to take the bandages off. You know, and you can see the kind of stories he's capable of making around this. The idea is this, that in order for something to function as a pramana, it has to be used as one. So that means that your mind has to be available to use the Upanishad as a pramana because it has something that it wants to make you see. And it's called Shabda Pramana. It means it's taking place through the use of words, right? To point out to you something that is actually here. Otherwise, it can't work as a pramana. If what it wants you to see is away from you, the words can only give indirect knowledge, right? But if what it wants you to see is the self-evident subject and the relationship of the self-evident subject to this world, then the words can make you see. You know? And so if your mind is open to letting the Upanishad do its job, then it will make you see this reality that we're experiencing in the way that it wants you to see it, which has to do with satyam vidya, the changeless nature of conscious, self-evident nature of consciousness, and the mityatva of everything else. That's what the Upanishad does. And so that takes tremendous Shraddha, especially for a Westerner, but for anybody. So say that Shraddha is there, then the Upanishad does its job. Okay? Then the mind, it's a Western mind or Eastern mind, it's a modern mind, is going to have its doubts. Those doubts have to be answered. In the second part of the second chapter of the Brahma Sutras, that chapter answers all of the doubts that were current at the time. All of the different philosophies that were out there available, in materialist philosophy, Sankhya, Yoga, Bauddha, the classical Buddhism, Nyayayikas, Vaisheshikas, and anything else they could think of. Right? All of those doubts of why can't it be like this, why can't it be like that, were systematically answered. And that brings a relaxation to the mind, gives dridha. Because then your mind doesn't have this it doesn't have this problem of, well, could it be like that or could it be like that? It sees it clearly. And whatever doubt might be there has been resolved. So if a doubt comes, the answer comes. For a while, only the answer comes. Because as soon as you have a doubt, the answer is there. That's clarity. And that's what we call dridha. Okay, so now, that's that verse. Now, the third one, the viparita bhavana. Bahujanma dridhabhyasat. Bahujanma dridhabhyasat. Dehadishvatma dikshanat. Dehadishvatma dikshanat. Punah punar udetyevam. Punah punar udetyevam. Jagat satyatva dhirapi. Jagat satyatva dhirapi. It says, it's talking about viparita bhavana. Now, bahu, janma, dridha, abhyasat, deha, adishu, atmadihi, kshanat, punaha, punaha, udeti, evam, jagat, satyatva, dihi, api. He says, bahu janma. Bahu means many. Bahu janma, many births. Dridha abhyasa. Because of the... Abhyasa is like the repetition or the practice or just the repeated dridha abhyasa. Just the... firm continuation. Yeah, of the many births, in many births, what? Dehadishu atmadihi. The atmadi, the notion of the atma in the deha, etc. Dehadishu, in the body, in the mind, everything that functions as an upadi. The atmadi, the di means the buddhi. You have the notion, you have the conviction, this is better. The conviction of yourself being the body, the mind, the sense organs, anything, any of the upadis, that conviction, because of it repeatedly occurring, birth after birth after birth, in other words, there's never a birth, you've had beginningless births, and there's never been a time when that conviction isn't there. So the abhyasa, the repetition of that conviction, is without a break, right? So it's an ongoing, repetitive conviction that I am the body, I am the mind, I am the sense organs, I am this person, I am this jiva, I am this body-mind complex. That's an ongoing, repeated conviction, right? Through many births, beginningless births. So that he says, kshanat. In a moment's time, a kshana means, kshana just means, just take some, in the quickest moment, just in a moment's time, punah punaha, again and again, udeti, it rises. What rises continually? This is even after shravana manana, right? This dehatma buddhi. That I am this physical body, mind, sense organs. Just kshana, just in a flash, just like that. It will rise again and again and again. Yeah. That I am the body, I am the mind, I am this person. Okay? Yeah. And he says, and in the same manner, udeti means rises. Okay, evam, in the same manner, jagat satyatva dihi api. In the same manner, also what rises is the conviction that this world is real. Jagat Satya means I, because the instant I take myself, the conscious being, me, to be this body, mind, sense organs, then I immediately become an entity, a real entity in this real world, right? A duality becomes reality, right? This world that I experience, say, before I have knowledge, this world, the physical reality world that I live in, is the reality, and I am an individual being in it. This world is the real world, and I am different from it, and I have to make my way. So, I mean, it's like a bouncing ball, you know, down into absolute samsara. The bouncing ball into samsara. Because then I'm a real person. I am subject to birth and death, of course. I'm subject to illness. And I am subject to unhappiness. I am subject to not getting my way. I am subject to the world not giving me and taking care of me and giving me what I think that I need in order to be a whole and complete person. For me to be a whole and complete person, I need the world to be in this way. Because as the instant I take myself to be this, right, then I am dependent on the world, right, for my ananda. Right. So the whole thing, it's a bouncing ball. On then what happens is that the whole reality of my being gets superimposed onto the world. It's not just the existence. If the sut, the existence, the amness of myself becomes one with this body. Therefore I become finite, right? The amness, the existent conscious being, becomes one with this body, mind, sense organs. With the body, it becomes one with the body, I become finite. It becomes one with the mind. I become continually changing. Right? This means I'm subject to death. It's continually changing, but still. It has a certain longevity. But I know it'll die someday. The mind has no longevity. Right? With the mind, I'm subject to continual change, and the mind becomes even the most threatening. Because the conditions of the mind go from sukha to dukkha. Right? It's always changing, but I can handle that. But it's the moods. Right? But we want the mind to always be changing, and what would I do? I mean, I need to be able to function. You need a changing, quick mind. So that's not really the problem. The problem is the emotions, the sukha and dukkha, the sorrow that causes that this finitude, this changing world is causing me. Right? Because it's not always changing in a way that I want. All of these kind of problems are there, and I have beginningless lifetimes of this identification that is responsible for the manifestation. Identification, this ajnana, that's responsible for the manifestation of all of the sorrow. Right? Because in reality, the source of your well-being and your ananda, its source is changeless and limitless. And it's never away from the mind. That's the reality. Right? But the mind, because of this dridha abhyasa, through many lifetimes, right? It's just a repetitive occurrence of the notion that I am this body, mind, sense organs. Because of the lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes of that conviction, right? It will, in spite of my knowledge, in spite of my shravana and manana, in spite of my knowing, this conviction overwhelms again and again and again. That is called viparita bhavana. Okay? And that is what is removed by nididhyasana. So let's look at this definition of it and we'll stop. Viparita bhavaneyam. Viparita bhavaneyam. Ekagriyatsa nivartate. Ekagriyatsa nivartate tatvopadeshat prakeva tatvopadeshat prakeva bhavatyetat upasanat bhavatyetat upasanat. It says viparita bhavana iyam ekagriyatsa nivartate tatva upadeshat prak eva bhavati etat upasanat. It says, viparita bhavana iam. This is viparita bhavana. This instantaneous identification that comes again and again and again because of life of many, many previous lifetimes of samskaras means habitual thinking in that way. He says, this viparita bhavana is nivaritpate, removed by ekagriya, meditation. Ekagriya means single-pointedness. And he's going to be talking about this. I can't do this whole verse right now, but I just wanted to get the viparita bhavana out. It's through nididhyasana. Ekagriya means, eka means one, agra means point, single-pointedness. It means bringing the mind back to the reality of your own being. So it's nididhyasana, it's meditation. So through this ekagriya, through this meditation, this is how this viparita bhavana is removed. He says, tatra upadeshat prakeva, even before one gains knowledge of the truth, even before that, bhavati eta upasanat, this can be dealt with through upasana. I'll talk about that next week some. In the whole first portion of the Vedas, and it's also in the Upanishads, there's upasana on Ishvara. You still don't know yourself. You can't do nididhyasana on the Atma as Brahman because you don't have that knowledge. But you can do upasana and gain this single-pointedness, this ability to concentrate, do it on Ishvara. And so there are, in fact, elaborate upasanas. And they come even in the Upanishads, like in the Taittiriya begins with some beautiful upasanas. Brihadaranyaka, Chandogya, there's several upasanas where you're holding a vision of Ishvara. And when you're doing that, you're thinning out the ahankara also. You're thinning out your point of identification. So he brings that up. But in the end, as the jnani, when a person gains knowledge, we're not doing upasana, which is taking at the form of the Lord in one form or another. We're doing nididhyasana on the nature of the myself as Brahman. So sitting with that. So we'll look at that next week. Okay. So nididhyasana takes care of this ongoing identification, habitual identification. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
So Carol, they covered three. The
Tatparya Shravana.
The Tatparya was one.
And that's covered in the Samanvaya, the Jaya.
And then the clearing of why isn't it like this, why isn't it like that?
Tarka, that's in the second.
Right, and then the
Viparita Bhavana. Those are the three. Yeah. One has to do, so they say like this. One has to do with what do the Upanishad actually say? What is the vision of the Upanishads? You have to, through the teaching methodology, you have to get that vision. Then the doubts. Why can't it be like this? Why can't it be like that? That's manana. So bringing in other things, right? So shravana is the actual teaching of the, getting the vision of the Upanishads. And you can have doubts around what the Upanishad says. What does the Upanishad actually say? What is its vision? That's a different. That's a type of lack of nishta. You don't really understand. You don't have a vision. Then, how could it be like that? Why couldn't it be like this? That's manana. You see? Then nididhyasana is to break that dehatma buddhi. The viparita bhavana, that sense, which is erroneous, the sense of being, which is erroneous sense of being, where I take my being to be the body.
So
the viparita bhavana is taken care of by nididhyasana. What they call viparita bhavana, we call it dehatma buddhi. The buddhi, the conviction that the atma is the body, the dehatma buddhi.
So I guess I'm tired tonight. So really, this is the description of shravana manana and nididhyasana. Because initially it was like, why don't you get, what is it sort of blocks to knowledge?
Well, we're saying.
And how they're resolved, I guess. Is that it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Like if you say, when we have to go back a little ways, they were talking about the akhandakara vritti, right, in gaining knowledge, vritti vyapti, pala vyapti, how knowledge actually takes place, removing the ignorance. Once you get that knowledge, then shouldn't everything be fine? Right? You've got the knowledge, you've seen it. Why isn't it fine? Well, because there's doubts. And what are the types of doubts that come in to obscure the knowledge in one way or another? One is what the Shruti is actually saying. There's a lot, you know, in terms of Ishwara and all of these things, the vision of the Shruti. What does the Shruti say about this? What does the Shruti say about that? What is it saying? You know? And then, why couldn't it be like that? You know? And what about all the, you know, my mind identifying with the body, the dehatma buddhi. So shravana, manana, nididhyasana. So we say these are the sadhanas for what's called upaya nishta. To for gaining nishta, dridha, that firmness in this vision, in the thing to be known by the Upanishads, that which is to be gained. Gaining nishta in that which is to be gained is called upaya nishta. And that's gained by shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Upaya nishta is gaining firmness in the upaya, the means that are necessary to gain this knowledge, which is the antakarna, the mind. Right? So for you need to gain what we call purity of mind, antakarna shuddhi. That's upaya. The upaya is the thing that you use to gain this knowledge, which is your mind. Right? The upaya is the thing to be gained. So you need upaya nishta through karma yoga, you know, and through ekagriya, which means being able to be single-pointed. But really, it's antakarana shuddhi. Karma yoga, mumukshutvam, you know, the viveka, vairagya, shama, dhamma, paratitiksha, all of these things. The mumukshutvam, all of these qualities. That's for the antakarana shuddhi. You need that purity of mind so that the mind is available. But now the mind is available. Say, okay, I have the antakarana shuddhi. I have enough antakarana shuddhi. I have enough to gain this knowledge. And that antakarana shuddhi will go on increasing, but I have enough to gain that knowledge. So now this knowledge comes. What is the means for gaining the knowledge itself? Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. What does the shravana take care of? The shravana is what gives me the vision on all of the Upanishads, you know, are what thoroughly give the vision so that I see it. And manana takes care of all of the doubts. Well, why couldn't it be this way? Why couldn't it be that? Because this vision is, it's like night and day. It's going from being a jiva, an individual in this creation, to being the whole. That's a big jump, to go from the jiva to being one without a second. So that sambhavana artasya, the reality, the possibility of this being true. So your mind has to be able to say, this is true because, you know. That because is the tarka. Tarka means logic. So that the mind understands. It doesn't just see it. It sees it and it understands why it is so and why it can't be another way. Right? So otherwise you see it, but then you don't know, you can't say why it is true and why it can't be another way. That's manana. And nididhyasana is because the mind is so habituated over beginningless lifetimes, you know, to identification with the body and the world as real, it takes a while for, you know, the mind to relax into yourself. And so what nididhyasana does is give the mind time, it's meditative time, to sit with your own being, to sit with this vision, with the reality of it.
And what's sort of interesting, I guess, if I'm understanding this text correctly, is that they're talking about the akhanda akara vritti first. I mean, I know that the shravana and manana go on prior to that too, but what they're kind of describing in a way is that they're describing akhanda akara vritti first, and then in relation to that, the shravana, manana, and manana.
Yeah, because, well, you could take this in so many orders. This is the order that he did it.
Yeah.
He went through all of those verses, 10 verses or so, talking about vritti-vyapti and pala-vyapti, and how knowledge actually takes place. To understand, it was a whole discussion on whether, on how the Mahavakya works, and how the Mahavakya, Tattvamasi, Aham Brahmasmi, how that Mahavakya gives direct, immediate knowledge. And so from there, so it did all these verses on that, and then it went into the Vakya vritti and the pala-vyapti and vritti-vyapti and these things, how it actually happens in the antakarna, in the mind. Went into a whole analysis about that. And then he brings in a doubt. Well, if it works like that, then why am I not just free and clear once, you know?
Yeah.
So he says, well, then he brings up the fact that even Shankara says that you have to keep doing shravana, manana, nididhyasana until this vision is dritta. And then he says, why? Well, because there's three areas, especially where the mind can get into trouble. First of all, the Upanishads say many different things. So how to know exactly what the tatparya is? That has to, takes time. That has to be cleared up. It's not just like that. And then why couldn't it be set some other way? See, you know, and then the viparita bhavana. So this is a problem. I mean, this samsara, this mitya, is our reality, our experiential reality. It's like a dream character in a dream. Just imagine, what a feat for the dream character to recognize that this is a dream, and I'm part of this dream, and my being is the self of the whole thing. That requires so much. And to really know, you know, not just to believe, but to know that you have to really have analyzed it thoroughly and analyzed your own experience, what is stable and what is mitya and all of that. You have to see it all. And then the mind can, the mind, in a sense, it gives up. A better word is it relaxes. It gives up its ahankara, you know?
Yeah.
But because of knowledge. You can't ever make the mind give up its ahankara. You know? Or what are you going to do? Don't give up your ahankara. I'm just saying, you'll say no.
So that's when this instantaneous identification collapses on us, you know?
The instantaneous identification is just, it's so natural because of lifetimes, yeah.
Yeah.
And so you bring yourself, you bring your knowledge back.
Is that word?
Nididhyasana.
No.
Viparita bhavana.
No. The shana.
Shana, yeah. Shana. Chanat means just in a flash, momentary, you know, in a moment.
Yeah, it's just like that.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, you can have super clarity And the next moment, bingo.
Yeah. But that also has to do with vairagya, you know. Vairagya also, dispassion, vairagya, that accompanies knowledge. The more clear you are, the more vairagya your vairagya continues to increase. Vairagya causes a lot of problems, and that's also habitual. Lack of vairagya is habitual. I need this to be happy. I need this to be, and it's subtle.
To secure.
The lack of vairagya goes on into all different realms of psyche. It catches you by surprise. I need this to be this way. I need this to be that way. I need that to be. You know, so you just continually, you know, let go of these things. You know, you don't need it to be any particular way. But you know, it takes some time. You can't be too hard on your mind, because it's coming out of lifetimes of absolute conviction to the point of not even thinking that it would be something else. You know?
And then also for us, the traumatized in the West, psychologically, you know, not being whole, raised in a whole way. So then we really have that. You know, that lack of vairagya, because there's some part of you that didn't get nurtured or something, and so...
And that's those complexes that's also have to be... Yeah. That's why it's important, that's why psychology is important for us, to know how to take care of some of those wounded areas inside that haven't been properly...
Well, do you think it's a bigger job these days than in the distant past?
It's hard to say.
I mean, if you were 3rd century India?
I don't know. You know, I'm sure they had their own set of problems.
This intense?
Who knows? It's Kali Yuga.
Yeah.
We're moving into the darker realms.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they...
But who knows? You know, it's hard to say.
Somebody does talk about how the inner child will prevent the knowledge from taking place because it wants its problem solved.
Well, I know, but that's why psychology is important.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
really,
because, like, the... Just even without knowledge, it's like you won't... It's hard for a person to give up... Say to forgive or get over something, until they're actually, the child part inside has been taken care of. It's like if, because the psyche will feel, well, if I forgive that person or get over that, then nobody's going to pay attention to me. Nobody's going to take care of me. So I'm not going to let that happen. So what has to happen is we have to know how to go inside to actually reparent or help that part that's so hurt. So otherwise it won't let you move on, because you're moving on without it. Then it's just going to be left there in the dark.
And if you try to apply certain, I guess it is almost, it becomes spiritual bypassing. If you try to apply certain things, even that we learn in class, you know, to that aspect of yourself, it doesn't work. Because that part wants to be heard. Right?
It doesn't work. That's why understanding these psychological things are so important. Right. And you know, I mean, I can include them in, even when I'm teaching at CIS, when I teach meditation to the spiritual counseling students, and in Advaita Vedanta, I teach meditation. In Eastern Theories, I teach meditation. Every class. But I teach them this whole process that includes this inner dialogue and talking with the inner child, you know, and with different parts of the psyche. Because if you don't know how to do that, those parts are just left in the unconscious causing pain. And so there's a lot of different ways of releasing those parts in the psyche to allow them to mature. You know, and to get what they need. But if you don't teach that, even Swamiji teaches all of that now. Because if you don't, there's deep unrest in the psyche.
If you just say something like, oh, well, it's just Mithya, or don't worry, Kishore's taking care of it. I mean, it doesn't really help.
No, it's like saying, oh, your arm's broken, don't worry, it's just Mithya.
Oh, get over it.
Get over it, no problem. It's just your body. Yeah.
You're not your body anyway, so
what's
your problem?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, just like the physical body takes, and we don't question that, but you know, if you're sick, you do take care of it to make it well. But the mind also, you know, has problems, the unconscious and all of these things, and have things that are actually causing pain. And you have to take care of it. You have to take care of it with, in a knowledgeable way, you know.
Mm-hmm.